Okay, thanks, Everhard. I'm quite happy to be here. And one thing that I noticed here, I think most of us on a daily basis, we make use of what's called maybe called teacup turbulence to keep us awake. But I find here there's no compulsion in taking a walk across the street. So that is that. Then we see a lot of fluid dynamics. And now my intention is to talk about what we have learned about turbulence using some of the largest computers available in the United States. In fact, I would say that would be the most powerful computer that can be assessed today. And we'd like to also take a look at what we're going to do in the future because computers are advancing very fast. One of the questions that we have to ask ourselves is are we going to be ready? When that next generation of computers become available. I'd like to acknowledge support from NSF and the supercomputing centers. Some were supported by NSF, and one of them is supported by the Department of Energy. And also, of course, the research that I show, some of the ideas that I wanted to present are not entirely my own, and I would acknowledge the names of my collaborators as they come along. And so I try to divide my talk into three parts. One, to give you some idea of the general context, turbulence and petascale computers. Petascale is a term for 10 to the power 15. I'd like to make some general remarks about concerning the computers. I would like to look at what have we learned as examples of study turbulence intermittency, turbulent mixing, and turbulent dispersion. And then what we'd like to learn more about turbulence, of course, we all agree that turbulence is still a subject where that's very difficult. But in order to get there, we find that we have to learn something more about computing as well. So on this slide, I think I'm talking to a mainly turbulence-friendly audience. So the first item is more or less quite obvious. And then the second item probably is quite obvious too, about the merge of DNS. We try to simulate all the scales. And we use DNS to understand the basic physics. And we can use DNS to develop models. I would think personally that we seem to have focused more on physical understanding and not so much on the model development. That's something that we have to catch up to. And the petascale, as I said, that means 10 to the power 15, maybe operations per second. What's an operation is what's a floating point operation, addition, multiplication, and so forth. Sometimes you also worry about whether the size of a data set may actually approach 1 petabyte. And I'm not sure if anyone has really gotten 1 petabyte yet. That is very terrifying, in fact. If you look at a website called the top500.org, you see a graph that shows that over the last 25 years, there was evidence that computational power has been decreasing exponentially. And people who work in the computer, with the computer manufacturers, are fairly confident that that kind of trend will continue. Right now, we're at 2.4 petaflops. That is a theoretical peak, but though I would say that if you if somebody gives you a complete access with that computer, and you have a code that can run at 0.24 rather than 2.4 petaflops, that would be extremely remarkable.
What does that actually mean? I mean, if you have a computer that runs at 2.4 petaflops, I mean, it has to be also able to communicate inside.
Basically, the theoretical peak numbers are more or less for advertising only.
For advertisement only. Because you could take all the computers on the earth, put them together, and calculate a number, and say, yeah, so many petaflops. I mean, what would come out if
you
put computers on the earth? It's huge, right?
One of the biggest issues is how to let the various CPUs communicate with each other.
That's the main issue, right?
Yeah. I mean, computers have gotten more powerful not because a single CPU has advanced very much, but rather that people have found ways to connect together many CPUs at the same time. So it's a big history of DNS. I think it was quite appropriate yesterday. We had some remembrance of Steve Wozniak. He was the first person who originated the idea of DNS at all. And he worked with spectral methods and then pseudo-spectral methods. And then one of the first publications was by Jim Wallach and George Patterson. I'm not quite sure of that person's first name. So they were the first people who tracked free particles, and they used the 32-cube degree points. Quite quickly, people realized that DNS was very time-consuming, and so this motivated development of large-scale simulation, NDDR-NOT, in 1974. And then, as far as I'm concerned, one of the biggest developments was Vogalo. He developed an algorithm that people could use to simulate isotropic turbulence as well as homogeneous turbulence. And then, as you know, then people started to develop a similar. People started to have a similar degree of success for flows with more complicated boundaries. Kim Moore and most very highly cited publication, I think. And then during the mid 1990s, things seemed to have become stagnant for a while. I remember hearing somebody said that he was a little bit tired of simulating 512 cube. But then in 2002, there was another big development. Yoku Kaneda, I think he was here a few weeks ago, he simulated turbulence on the Earth simulator at 4096 cube. That was at a time, if I recall correctly, that then only one publication had passed the 1024 cube. As for the future, I think it's very fortunate for us that Yoko Kaneda was able to do the work on the Earth simulator, because I think he has a certain connection to NSF, has a solicitation for a computer that would be capable of simulating turbulence at 12,288 cubes, that's 3 times of 4096. Fourth order one scattered 10,000 times, steps in 40 hours. That was one of the acceptance test criteria for a machine to be called Blue Waters. I think the capacity is supposed to be a little more than 10 for the props, I think. This machine is not open, unfortunately, and I'm not free to say, I wouldn't say that I know very much, but I'm not. There are certain things that I'm not free to say. On the other hand, the word blue, I think, gives away the name of the manufacturer. And this computer is supposed to be available in 2012, as we hope. And what do we use a big computer for? Most of the time, we are focused on trying to get higher runoff numbers. But in our studies of turbulent mixing, it's important to deal with the regimes of very high Schmidt number. If you have a high Schmidt number, then the smaller scales in the scalar fields become very small, and so therefore you need very small spacing, therefore more grid points. Also, if you look at very low Schmidt number, now you will find that the large scales are getting larger, and so you need a larger solution domain. If you don't want to give up on accuracy on at a small scale, you need more grid points as well. And also, we could use more computational power to increase our accuracy of the results of the small scales, in particular, fine scale intermittency. Yesterday afternoon, a group of us were talking about high-order structure functions from Lagrangian quantities, but there are similar issues from Eulerian quantities as well. We could also use a more powerful computer to allow us to carry a longer simulation. Sometimes collect better sampling, but sometimes there are other reasons to do so as well. But as we do that, normally we accumulate a huge amount of data. Sometimes that is very difficult to deal with. Of course, some of us would like to use those computers to simulate flows in more complex physics, like density stratification, rotation, as well as magnetic hydrodynamics turbulence. I quoted these examples because they can all be studied meaningfully within the context of homogeneous turbulence. But of course, there are also, again, more complex boundary conditions like your channel boundary layers, mixing layers, and maybe pipe flows as well. So if we have access to a top-of-the-line machine, the world's biggest machine, what can we do? We potentially can compute faster if we have an efficient code. We can compute bigger in the sense that we can now look at a bigger problem. We can compute longer. We can analyze the data in more detail. But are our results going to be better? I would say hopefully. And sometimes there may be some issues that keep us from getting the correct results. One of the things that the computer manufacturers people like to say is that they don't want to design computers that let people get the wrong results faster. Okay, that's not of really really any good. Now, to get the best benefit, however, that's not trivial. We have to write a code that's capable of a massive parallelism. Now it's up to 10 to the power 5, so CPU cores. 10 years later, that may be 10 to the power 6. And a lot of times we talk about cyborg now. Well, what are some of the issues? How do we use the data? How do we reuse the data? Well, we generate a huge amount of data. No way to do all the processing, doing the simulation. After all, this is just what we do in research. So we do something, and then we figure out that maybe we better get something else, and then we'll go back to the data. We want to look at the data again. But how do we maintain the data that we are? In our group, I think we have 100 terabytes or so. Well, so far I'm relying on the supercomputer center to keep the data for me for free. I would be in big trouble if one day they're not able to do that. And how do we share the data is also another issue. How do you transfer files of data that last to other machines? There's also intense competition for computational resources versus other fields. We may say that we have access to a very powerful computer. Unfortunately, that computer is not devoted to turbulence, unlike Eberhard's facility in Germany. So we have to write proposals, and sometimes people refer to a kind of turbulence that's called allocation turbulence. Right? We don't quite know what happens sometimes. Because of the competition from other fields, especially I think other fields of science, sometimes in my view, they seem to have a better degree of success in arguing that their works are beneficial to society and that their data are widely available, usable by a larger group of users and so forth. Sometimes we have to develop a new programming model. By a programming model, I mean just a new way of programming, basically. Try to simplify that. If somebody is going to tell you you have to completely rewrite the code in order to execute efficiently on a new machine, that's not always the kind of news that you would like to hear. But nevertheless, we get good signs only if good questions are being asked, and that's why we need collaborators, and we need for the efficiency of all of this, we need human beings and computers working together well. For example, sometimes whenever we have a new computer, there's a certain period for some people to sign on as so-called early users. They're also called friendly users because they're supposed to report the problems to the consultants so that the consultant get them fixed.
So, BK, the big difference between numerics and experiment is that the experiment I can repeat. And I get my data by repeating the experiment, while in numerics it seems we get one shot of having these computers once for a short period of time and produce a huge database. And then a lot of effort has to go in how to make access to the database.
Right.
There's actually a lot of CPU time, and I mean, there's a whole new computing problem. This is a whole new challenge to allow people to access the data.
Yes.
And to store the data in a way that it can be easily used by many people in the world, because I mean these databases are extremely valuable.
Yeah. And also
so an experiment, you blast a lot of energy out. I just calculated this machine that you were talking about, 10^6 or 10^7, how many processors?
Sorry?
10^6 processors, right? CPUs.
When 10^6
cores.
Huh?
Is what you said, right?
Yeah.
So if each one uses 10 watts.
Right.
You said there's 10^5 cores right now.
Yes.
Right? That's what you had on your former slide. This means it's a megawatt of power.
Yes.
Right?
So sometimes some of the supercomputer centers, of course, they would like to get money from NSF to build a big machine. Then they have to worry about who's going to pay the power bills.
Why you only get a chance once.
And I hear that some universities do not want to compete because of that. Because they will not know where to put the computer on their campus. Okay, now we go into turbulence a little now. The methods that I use to study turbulence, I think, are fairly standard. Previous pseudo-spectral after Vogalo. And in the resolution, we most simulations where our intention is to push the Reynolds number to as high as possible. We normally have a weak spacing divided by the Kolmogorov scale, which is close to 2. So that means the Kolmogorov limit scale is not fully resolved. Now, there are going to be effects on the intermittency that I think we look at that in the paper in Physics of Fluids 2008, first off with Diego Dantas. And we would say that high order quantities are sensitive, but lower quantity order quantities are more or less still okay. And so it would be fortunate that most of these conclusions that we have been going around saying for a number of years still remain qualitatively valid. And then we are more interested in pressure scalars also, where we have a uniform mean gradient. This is an equation for the scalar fluctuation after a Reynolds decomposition. Capital phi here is the mean scalar field, and we'll let the mean scalar field have a uniform mean gradient. We just choose it arbitrarily 1, 0, 0 along one along the x direction and 0 along the other two directions. We can do that because the velocity field considered is isotropic turbulence. And that will allow us to look at issues of localized isotropy. And one of the important considerations is the size of the smaller scale, for each scalar that we have to resolve. That depends on its main number. Certainly, in small convenience, that we want to simulate two scalars of different Schmidt number. You want to do them together in the same simulation. You don't want to simulate the velocity field twice. Unfortunately, when we do that, we also have the implication that out of the same simulation, the statistics or the accuracy of the statistics for the different scalars may not be the same, may not be the same level. We have a massively parallel code. In principle, we can scale it up to n squared processes. That means if n is 1024, then n squared is 1,000,000, although no machines of that size exist yet. We presented our results at a conference sponsored by the TurgGrid. TurgGrid is a network of supercomputer centers supported by NSF. As you might wonder now, this prefix is getting out of style. Okay, as far as I know, it's not going to be changed to something called PetaGrid, but then that name is going away in a few months, as far as I understand. So as for the simulation database here, this is our lambda, the Taylor scale Reynolds number, the number grid point in this direction. Kmax theta, that's a parameter that says something about the grid resolution, the higher the better. And then you have the Schmidt numbers here. And I've highlighted in web 3 4096 script simulation. Both of them have been run for quite a while. We just have to devote enough time to analyze the data and get more papers out of that. And those things in blue here are the reasons why these simulations were done. In one case, we want to go to relatively high Schmidt numbers. In one case, we want to resolve the small scale better, and of course, in this case here, we want to have a Reynolds number relatively high. And that is very close to 1,000. It happens over a period of about 5 editions over times. We also have done some recent ones of larger domains and also a very low Schmidt number. I'll show that as well. Well, so what have we learned about intermittency and extreme events?
Okay. In the database, what is stored? What is sitting on the computer? What is actually stored? Is it the time steps?
There are two. Okay. We can say that there are three kinds of data. One is the processing output, for example, the energy spectrum, and a series of time steps. That is relatively small. The other is that we have Eulerian velocity field and cube grid points. We cannot do that too often because the data sets are huge. We do that every certain fraction of the editor over time. So sometimes it depends on how long can we run on the queue, because the computer don't belong to us. So if we submit a job, the job goes up to the queue, and then we can run maybe 12 hours, and we have to save the data sometime in between and then close to the end. And the third type of data will be the Lagrangian time series.
That's all this data is existing?
Most of it, but in some of those ones, we did not track three particles.
Okay. How many particles, typically?
of order 1 million. It's not very large. But okay, about dissipation and entropy. Dissipation is twice of the viscosity times the square of the strain rate, summing all the components. And then entropy is a square of the vorticity, if you multiply by the kinematic viscosity, then we find that in homogeneous turbulence, they will have the same mean values, but although the moments and the PDFs are in general different. So both of these quantities represent the small scales. One is a symmetric part of the velocity gradient tension, and the other is the anti-symmetric part. And most data sources in the past have said that, even now, suggest that entropy is more intermittent. That's contrary to expectation of high Reynolds numbers in the paper by Nelkin, 1999. And strain and rotation, really they do different things. If we think about a pair of free particles, the strain rate can pull them apart. And the rotation rate, if they are in the vortex, then they would probably rotate around with each other, not moving very far apart in that process. Now, and there are some difficulties in resolution and sampling because both of these quantities are just subject to really extreme events. And then let me show you the PDF here. So this is the PDF of the fluctuating epsilon divided by the mean. And there are some samples here up to 2,000 times the mean. And in fact, there are some going to 4,000. Although at 4,000, the statistical sampling was not very good, and we would not be seeing a smooth curve like this. And also, there is some interest in trying to fit the form of these PDFs by so-called stress exponential. But what is the most remarkable, I think, to us was that if you look at 200 times the mean, 400 times the mean, these two PDFs are different. If you go towards 2,000 or past 1,000, they start to come together. So the most extreme events, or those strongest events, are those where we have large fluctuations simultaneously or both. And this is not something that we would see at low Reynolds numbers. At low Reynolds numbers, these PDFs would basically go here. It would be very difficult to catch a sample, let's say 1,000 times a mean, if we were to simulate at lower Reynolds numbers. So we first said that this observation in the papers in physics of first 2008, when our solution was 2048 cubed. Since then, we have done 4096 cube, and this 4096 cube, we see more or less the same things. And also, if we go look at the data in more detail, what happens is that if you have an extreme epsilon, that almost guarantees that you have extreme entropy, but not vice versa. Okay. And entropy, this line is still above that of dissipation. So entropy is still more intermittent than dissipation at this Reynolds number, but the trend is that they are going to become closer and closer to at higher Reynolds number. And I've not done much of flow visualization, so this is an image just made by the visualization experts at Texas Advanced Computing Center. It's a 2048 cube, and now number 650. What they have done is that they have intense entropy as red and dissipation as blue. And this image on the left-hand side is a full 2048 cube. And then they zoomed in a certain part of it, put it out, and it is like this. So it's more or less consistent with what we know, that the entropy is more or less worm-like like this. But the visualization of very large data sets is also very difficult to know. Okay, well, take a look at why are we interested in whether epsilon, large epsilon and large entropy occur simultaneously. Here we'll look at the Poisson equation for pressure fluctuation, P over wall here, a half of entropy minus epsilon divided by nu. And so if we can get hold of epsilon, if we can get hold of capital omega, we know the Laplacian of the pressure. The question is, does that give us an idea of about what the pressure field is like? And here I have tried to shown a contour plot of the mean pressure condition of these on these variables. So we can define the look at this in form of four quadrants. This quadrant, this is what we call the first quadrant, where both dissipation and entropy are high. And then here, that means you have high dissipation, but low entropy. So and the difference between these two is one of number. If you look at R lambda to 1,000, you will see that if you go along a diagonal line like this, there is not perfect symmetry, but there is a certain tendency to it. So, and also, in other words, and also, okay, the solid, I think the contour levels are too difficult to see, but the solid lines are positive contour levels, and dashed lines are negative contour levels. And we can see that both, if you have a high Reynolds number, if you have high dissipation, which is this half, you have high entropy, which is the top half, then you'll get consistently negative values of the conditional mean pressure. So both intense entropy and intense dissipation can lead to negative pressure fluctuations. But the problem that we have encountered, though, however, is that pressure is a non-local variable. It's very difficult to make a direct connection between the Laplacian of the pressure and the pressure itself. That is what that's one of the issues that we are still thinking about. And next, let me look at turbulent mixing. As I said before, the Schmidt number is a parameter that we are very interested in. The Schmidt number varies tremendously from 0.01 or even less in liquid metals. I think in astrophysics, if I'm correct, can be even smaller. And then of order one for people interested in combustion, if you heat transfer in water, that's about 7. For salt in the whole thing, that's almost 1,000. And the smaller scales of the field, of the scalar field, conventionally are defined by the so-called Oberhof Coffin and Batchelor scales, this type of dependence for the Schmidt number. And there are some different regimes depending on what the range of Schmidt numbers. But there are relatively few data available for Schmidt number much greater than 1, because in experiments, I would say you have to measure, you have to have very, very good instrumentation. You have to measure the very fine scales as well, with much less than 1. Think about liquid metals, the experiment, I believe, are not so easy to do, and there are a lot of safety precautions so far. Some of the main questions we ask, in addition to the scaling regimes themselves, to say what is, if we have a mean gradient imposed on the scalar field, do the small scale remain isotropic, or do they become isotropic? Does the answer depend on what the Schmidt number is, in addition to the Reynolds number? And similarly, what about intermittency in the scalar field? This is the classical form of the spectrum. This is a relatively direct extension of Kolmogorov 1941 by Oberhof and Coulson. And so the spectrum exponent is k to the minus 5 thus, supposed to apply for an intermediate range of wave numbers. And this is a graph from a paper in 2005. We have, which is a Schmidt number 1/8 here, and this is 1. And we find that there is a certain region which looks relatively flat, and it happens at a scaling constant. Oberhof Coffin constant is quite consistent with a survey by experiments with a survey of experiments by Schwinner in 1996. There is a behavior that is sometimes called the bottleneck. Actually, if we're going to measure the slope of this part here, the slope is close to 1/3. So that implies that in this part of the spectrum, is actually close to k to the minus 1. This is called the Batchelor spectrum. And here I've added some data points here the solid triangles and circles. These are data points by Toshi Goto's work. I think again he was here a few weeks ago, and he that he can maintain the scalar fluctuations in a different way. It's interesting that that both methods lead to approximately the same expression of the scalar. Although, of course, if we have an isotropic mechanism for providing the scalar fluctuation, then we will not see any deviation from local isotropy. If a Smith number much greater than one, that's the so-called Batchelor spectrum, one of his papers, that was from the paper Batchelor in 1959. So there's a K to the minus one. And here we have in the the arrow is going in the direction of the increasing Smith number, and the data points we get there are several groups of data points. They all represent different Reynolds numbers and different grid resolutions for the same Smith number among themselves. And we can see that there's a trend towards k to the minus one. And then, on the other hand, the value of the Batchelor scaling constant is not so trivial. From all the data that we know about, including our own DNF, our value of the so-called Batchelor constant is about 2.5 times larger than what Batchelor originally proposed. And we tried in the paper last year, this is flow turbulence and combustion. You know, we look at the PDF of the most compressive principal strain wake, and I think we have some informal explanation of why this is about five or so. If you plot against Reynolds number or against, if you plot against the Smith number. And then going to the other extreme, extremely low Smith number. And I've done the simulation. Actually, this was done only a few days ago. So I have to say, emphasize this is preliminary. This is tentative, but the quality of the data to be improved. The Smith number we start with Smith number 1/8 and drop it by a factor of 4, 1/32, 1/128, and 1/512. And the main thing to do is that we need a larger solution domain. Normally in DNS we talk about in periodic boundary condition we talk about the domain of length 2 pi. In this case we have 4 pi. On the other hand we don't want to lose the Reynolds number, so that means we need to use more grid points. So and this is a normalized spectrum. And this is Kolmogorov scale wave number, Smith number 1/8, 1/32, 1/28, 1/512. The thing that I'm relatively confident of is that the data for the two lower Smith numbers are showing some support for k to the minus 17/3. Okay. Although I think there's some numerical issues at the end here for these two lines, then we'll be going to the so-called viscous diffusive range. So I was talking to Rick Hill a couple of days ago. We'll try to see if we can understand the behavior here better. But I think there's some numerical issues here. So maybe the real thing is actually something that would fall more steeply, especially for 19. Okay, for local isotropy or local anisotropy, usually people look at the properties of the scalar gradients in a direction parallel to the mean gradient and see if that it becomes different from that of those components perpendicular to the mean scalar gradient. And so this component along the mean gradient usually has a negative skewness. And here I plotted the negative of the skewness. So that it becomes positive as a function of Smith number, and different symbols represent different Reynolds numbers. If we have our lambda ridiculously low, perhaps then we can get a Smith number almost 1,000. And then, if you want to have high Reynolds numbers, of course you cannot go very far in terms of the Smith number. But in general, we find that if we go from Smith number 4 onwards, that is a trend that the skewness is going down. That's so with respect to increasing Smith number. As for what about high Reynolds numbers? That is a little more difficult to tell, But in a paper last year, we find that if we compare simulations at the same model's number but different number of grid points, then the simulation providing better resolution are actually supporting a return to isotropy for the scalar field, for Schmidt number one. Unfortunately, that is very expensive to do. As on a routine basis, I think. As for the inefficiency of the scalar gradients, we can look at the flatness spectrum of the scalar gradients, and this is what I have plotted as a function of Schmidt number. Again, different colors represent the different Schmidt numbers. And the trend is that if you follow the data at the same Reynolds number, as Schmidt number goes relatively high, this curve starts to level off. So beyond a certain value, beyond a certain threshold, the intermittency of the scalar field appears to saturate. And it also, we also find that, let's say if you look at the data in purple as a higher Reynolds number, then you don't have to go that far in terms of the Schmidt number. Okay. So in some sense, the Schmidt number becomes less important. Although I won't say that it becomes unimportant, but it becomes less important if the Reynolds number is high. The third part here, what have we learned about turbulent dispersion? By looking at turbulence in a Lagrangian point of view, this may repeat some of what I gave yesterday afternoon. I think we all go back to 1921 G.I. Taylor as the beginning of the study of the Lagrangian description of turbulence, and then 5 years afterwards, Richardson, 1926, came up with a paper about particle pairs. It's remarkable, I think, that both of these papers were 15 to 20 years before Kolmogorov. They were the more or less the first what we might call classical papers from the last century. We can also go look at multiparticles, and some in the audience, they're all sitting on this side. They have studied those phenomena as well, that can give us some useful information about the structure of the flow. And in DNS, of course, we can track free particles, and the method we use is cubic spline interpolation. That's the main thing we do in order to evaluate the particle velocity at the instantaneous position of the free particle. But the same kind of interpolation mechanism, same kind of interpolation, you can replace this U by some other variable. You can do the same thing for the velocity gradient. So you can interpolate for the velocity gradient following that's the Eulerian velocity gradient, but evaluate it along the particle positions. And we can provide quite a lot of detail and I have worked with some researchers in stochastic modeling to help try to make the data useful. So the classical picture about Kolmogorov similarity in Lagrangian terms has to do with the Lagrangian structure function. This is the second order structure function. And the behavior of that depends on how much of a range of time scales we have. The smallest time scale would be Kolmogorov time scale. The largest time scale would be the Lagrangian integral time scale, which is the integral of the autocorrelation function rho L of tau, which is the correlation between U plus of T and U plus of T plus tau. And then in the classical argument is that this might go like some constant called C zero epsilon tau. To test that, you divide the left-hand side by epsilon tau and see whether we get a peak. Well, see whether we get a plateau. So what we get is more like a peak rather than a plateau. And although there is some trend that here for the peak value here, the normalized peak value as a function of R lambda, there's some trend that it might be going towards 7. But our big difference.
Okay. Sorry, typically the dimensional estimate for TL over tau eta is that it should go linearly with R lambda. Hmm?
So when you say the tau lambda is 1,000, and you have a tau TL over tau eta 80, yeah. It means that the p-factor is 0.1, almost.
Yes. Yes. That's our problem. Hey, if that factor were larger, then we would be in better shape. And actually, I'm going to show on the next graph here. This is a plot of the timescale ratio as a function of R lambda. This is actually log scales. Mm-hmm. So do you get a line of slope 1?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So
the p-factor?
Pardon?
The p-factor is 0.1, almost.
No, I mean the slope is 1. I'm not paying that much attention to the factor. If you go, okay, with this graph here, 1,000 here, indeed you get about 880 on the y-axis.
Okay, thank you.
So this is the curve fit that Brian made using data from other sources, that explains some of the other symbols placed a little differently. But even those this group of symbols, they seem to follow the same slope. And now, if you think about stochastic modeling, what do they need? They need to have a coefficient to represent the deterministic drift and also the randomness at a small scale. So that's part of the reason, I think, why people are so interested in the value of C0, and they in addition to the timescale ratio. And this here is a slightly different symbol here, but this is also the normalized Lagrangian second order structure function. This plot was made by Sivpo, where he compared the DNF data with a model by Brian Sofort, which is the first 20 years ago. And for modeling purposes, perhaps this is a reasonable fit, but then there are some discrepancies here. There are some discrepancies here as well, and the situation becomes more critical at higher orders. So higher order structure functions, this is absolute order, this is the nth order absolute structure function. Take the magnitude first before we ratio it to some power. And then this is divided by the Kolmogorov scaling estimate, and tau over tau eta here, going from orders 1 to 10. And if Kolmogorov 1941 were valid, then this would be flat. It might look like so, well, I'm B, but then I would say that this is a log scale. So there are certain things that we might not have seen otherwise. But definitely, as the order goes higher and higher, the deviation becomes more and more substantial. But the study of high-order structure functions is very difficult. Actually, we look at this part very carefully, we see that some of these lines are not quite right, unfortunately. Because if tau over tau eta were small enough, well, maybe they're not exactly wrong, but then they're not showing the whole picture. So if tau over tau eta were sufficiently small, then we can do a Taylor series expansion for the velocity. And that means that the n order structure function will be proportional straightly to tau to the power n. Tau to the power n divided by tau to the power n over 2 would be tau to the power n over 2. So it would be going up. There's a certain part of the curve that's missing, it's something like this that we're not seeing. Okay, of course, we could one could try to fix that situation by reducing the time stepping. One could try to fix that situation by collecting the data over sufficiently small time intervals. Okay, those are the matter of computational time as well.
Okay, one question, which I wanted to ask yesterday. Did you compare the maximum the location of the maximum with what we have published? We have a similar plot, right? Published.
Yeah, that's right.
We have a similar plot published I think we published it, right? Yeah, sure. The Fusserov letter. And we measured the location of the maxima.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering whether the location of your maxima agrees with the location of the maxima for our PRL.
Okay, let me go back.
Something you can look at. Did you look at that?
You're talking about either this one?
No, the other one. The higher order structure functions. You know, the maxima, the location of this maxima we have measured up to
this maximum?
8.
I don't think that has inertial wind significance. You can see that the maximum occurs
But just to see whether this information agrees, you know, I mean, it would be interesting. Nothing very important. I mean, it's just.
Well, I think the behavior of the curve is. Well, I should do with the normalization method that we use.
You know, in this paper, we just have basically the location of the maxima. It's the same curve. I mean, we have published the same curves, okay. Just higher, better time resolution,
okay.
Because we can go to higher order structure functions. And
okay,
it would be nice to see how they compare.
Is the location of the maxima something universal, or does it depend on how things are being forced and stuff?
I don't know. That's why it would be interesting to see, right?
Okay. Well, one other thing that I've been trying to work on for the last few years, see if we can connect the Eulerian structure of the flow, or the small scale intermittency in the Eulerian sense to what happens in the Lagrangian framework. Well, the Lagrangian framework, we know that the acceleration can be very large compared to its RMS value. If you have a large and a large acceleration, certainly can be the result of the free particle in the region of a large velocity gradient. So if your free particle is sampling the local velocity field, and if the local velocity field is changing rapidly as a function of distance, then it follows that the free particle velocity will change rapidly as well. So, and then if you think about the velocity gradients, local velocity gradient, then you can decompose it into the strain rate and the rotation rate, and you can lump them up all up if you like, so that we have dissipation, entropy, and pseudo dissipation. One can look at whether the results are different. Let's say if you look at the acceleration condition on epsilon and acceleration condition on omega, see if they look different. And in order to understand this, you will need some other information, right? We have to know what are the time scales of these variables, but we have data to compute that. Then we also look at the use of conditional sampling. Let's say that you are looking at the free particle velocity from time t to t plus tau, and we know about condition on the value at time t at the beginning of the time interval of any one of these three variables. If any one of these three variables are large at time t, it seems like very likely that the velocity will change rapidly, and therefore the decorrelation will happen more quickly. And we have plots to show that. I have skipped this one today, though. We would also expect that there will be no dependence after some time, because these variables are not expected to be very long lasting, especially if they were going to be large anyway. And so we have to follow up, but I think we have the beginnings of some ideas about how to introduce the effects of fine scale intermittency in stochastic modeling. That's in a paper by I'm a co-author on that, but it was a paper by a student of St. Paul at Cornell. And then I'll look at the conditional structure function instead of the conditional autocorrelation. In stochastic modeling, what do we want to know? Fundamentally, say, given the current information, we try to predict the future by trying to figure out what are the statistical characteristics of this increment. But if we know something more, just the current time, but we know something about what happened yesterday or the day before and so forth. If we have more information, given the current velocity and the current acceleration, then we can predict the increment of the acceleration. Then we can get the new acceleration, and from there you can do an integration to recover the velocity, and from there we can get the displacement. We can also say, well, given velocity and epsilon, or the velocity and entropy, what are the effects of the fine scale intermittency? And we have defined a quantity called the conditional fatness factor. Namely, say, if you look at these conditional variables, try to find out whether they are Gaussian or not. And we find that there is roughly something that might be called conditional Gaussianity. I say roughly because we know that if you think about acceleration is proportional to the velocity increment over a small time interval tau. The acceleration is very intermittent, but if you condition the acceleration on any one of these variables, then the Gaussian energy goes down substantially. So what I think it tells us is that the intermittent, the non-Gaussianity really comes from those conditioning variables that we use. And Federico and others have been looking at the local stuff for some time. And I have tried to do the same thing here, but I'm trying to look at this for the do the same thing for the conditional structure function. And these lines on all of these plots, the lines A, B, C, D, E are in the direction of the increasing entropy, increasing dissipation. And if you look at small tau, tau over tau e to less than one, high dissipation and high entropy, we are doing more or less the same thing to the data. Something different happens here. There is something special about entropy that I have not fully understood. Although I suspect that if you go to if you go to this graph for dissipation, there is a little bit of it, not as strong. That occurs at about 2 to 4 Kolmogorov time scales. And I think there was a discussion a couple of days ago what happens at large tau, and I've thought about that since then. I can't really reach a conclusion upon that because at large tau, both the fourth order structure function and the second order structure function, they both approach constants. The question becomes how quickly one approaches the constant relative to the other. But because of sampling, because it's very difficult to find out what's going on, what exactly is going on. And so I have chopped off this curve also at about 40 Kolmogorov time scale. I think I'm taking too long. So I'll briefly just skip over this slide. This is relates to a work done by a student who has just graduated. And this is about four particle, basically tetrads. So we can define the size of the tetrad by the volume, or better yet, by the gyration radius. I say better yet, especially because the volume sometimes can be zero. If you have four particles in a tetrad lining up in the same plane for any reason, for short periods of time, the volume goes to zero. But the gyration radius will never do that. We are trying to look at some measures of the shape of the tetrad. The size of the tetrad on the left hand side and the shape on the right hand side. So these are the arrows are going in the direction of increasing initial size. And we figured out that if Richardson scaling applies, then we would have a plateau or some scaling range at the level 3g over 2. And this seems to happen a little bit around the level of 0.85, which suggests Richardson constant about 0.56. That is quite consistent with our analysis of the particle pair data. On the other hand, if you look at the shape, what I'm showing is lambda. Lambda is made up from the volume and the gyration radius to be a non-dimensional quantity, and it strictly falls between zero and this number, which is at about 0.16. And we find that now here there is a more well-developed sweat scaling range. Most of the data for a relatively wide range of initial tetrad sizes, they all spend some time here. And we identified that at about 0.45. If you were able to run the simulation long enough, we cannot run the simulation long enough because it's 4096 cubed. But for some smaller simulation, if you run it long enough, then it approaches a value that we can be established by Monte Carlo calculation at about 0.645. The paper is in the proofreading stage. I'm hoping that it will come out by the end of May. Okay, then let me go back to the title of the talk more or less. What do we want to know? some issues in turbulence. We can make up a very long list, of course. So this is sort of an arbitrary collection of what I'm thinking about. We'd like to establish a causal connection between pressure and dissipation and entropy. As I mentioned, we know dissipation and entropy, then we know the path of the pressure. But unfortunately, we don't know the pressure itself. We can do an integration in the case. And we'd like to have a graph showing data from low Schmidt number 0.01 to 1 all the way to 100. Okay. We'd like to have a unified view of the Schmidt number dependence. All of these quantities, I have not. I'm computing a structure transfer. I'm not showing all the results yet. Local isotropy intermittency, and we would like to not go to lower Schmidt number or higher Schmidt number, some reasonably high Reynolds number. We'd like to look at the Lagrangian intermittency in greater detail. Brian Shofford has been making a number of plots using my data. So we're looking at some refined similarity issues here, hopefully useful for stochastic modeling. As for TNS, we would like to have a clearer idea of what are the effects of resolution. I think for resolution, we know more or less no. It's a matter of degree. If your small scale is not sufficiently well resolved, then of course high order quantities will be less accurate. But we want to be more practical in looking at that. We cannot insist that we are going to resolve the small scale up to a certain extent, but rather we should say, if we resolve the small scale to a certain degree, then what are the errors? How much error can we expect? Same thing for the domain size. It would be nice to have from go 2 pi, 4 pi, 8 pi, 16 pi, 32 pi, so forth. But then if we do that, the simulation time, I mean, the CPU hours required would become infinite. And likewise, the time span of the simulation. And that, of course, is the effect of all more complex physics on everything else, or you can say, well, what are any of these phenomena more sensitive to the issues that we consider above? So what are some of the cyber challenges? Some computer manufacturers are being very confident in predicting that by 2018 we will arrive at so-called exascale. Then the world's fastest computer will be about 1,000 times faster than what we have now. And nobody quite knows how those computers will look like. Whether those computers will even run Fortran, run MPI, and so forth. How do we scale our codes efficiently to so many cores? In fact, right now we are at around 10 to the power 5, the largest system in the world, not the fastest. I'm not quite sure about the number of CPU cores in the computer in China, but I know that the fastest computer in the US, which is now number 2 in the world, is the Cray XT5 at Oak Ridge National Lab that has about 225,000 or so, 224. Well, we may need to program very differently, unfortunately. We may have to adapt to our lives or to the kind of architectures that become available. Right now we're looking at how we program on a computer where you have multiple execution units on one CPU node. So there are some memory can be shared and some memory have to be distributed, divided by among the different processors. And we're learning to use how to use graphical processor units. There's a perception that graphical processor units will be very fast, and they may be, but then the problem may still be that we would have to distribute memory among the different processors. So I'm working with a colleague at Georgia Tech who knows a lot more about GPUs and see what we might be doing. And all of these will require massive effort. I think some of us running production codes may even have, I don't know how many subroutines, how many lines. If somebody were going to tell you that you have to change the core, fundamental core of your program dramatically, as I said, that's not very good news. And now, if we are convinced or we are forced to undertake a massive amount of effort in doing so, unfortunately, there's some risk that all of that may be gone for nothing. Right now, the situation is that if you try to look at GPUs, you have a program running on a GPUs, and the largest GPU machine that you have may be a few hundred cores. A few hundred cores, a GPU machine versus a traditional CPU, you can't tell any difference. And how do you predict what happens when both CPU and GPUs could go to? How can we predict, say, a few years in the future, what will it be like? So if somebody gives me access to the machine now, the big machine now, maybe I can test the program, but right now, what I can assess it as most, a small piece of the machine. How do we compete better with other fields for computer time? In California, if you have something that works above earthquakes and so forth, people always pay attention. But how do we work with what I would call big data here? 2 terabytes of data, what do we do with it? No single researcher can really absorb them all. And how do we engage the community? Can we try to be more collaborative? I know that in some other communities, they share not only the data, but also the code. They have what is called a community code. They will put it on some website. You can download the code, you can run it. And somebody somehow make sure that you have a little time to run. But as far as I know, the turbulence community has not been operating that way. But I don't know whether that is too difficult to change, or whether we really want to change like that. And then I mentioned a machine called Blue Water, which is funded by NSF. It will have a theoretical peak about 10 petaflops. And the hope is that we can run at what's called sustained 1 petaflop. If we can run at 10% of the machine, that would be really fantastic. And it will have at least 300,000 cores. And I believe at least 300,000 is public information. What exactly is that number is supposed to be confidential. So we should be able to do a 8192 qubit simulation. In fact, we are virtually assured right now of the access to the machine for that purpose. But at the same time, are we going to be just doing another hero simulation? What about 4096 qubit, 2048 qubit, 1024 qubit? Okay, because we do not necessarily want to launch into a huge hero simulation until we're perfectly sure that is what we want to do. Okay, because once we get the CPU hours, then we have to use the data. And then the last thing is, what will we be doing by 2018?
If we are alive.
Okay. I don't know. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, didn't they have it right? What was the movie? The answer to the universe is what? 47? Is it 49?
42.
The answer was 42. What was the movie called? Hitchhiker Through the Galaxy, right? And this is like what we need here. We have these big, huge computers, and all they get at the end is one number. You would have no data processing problems, right? Because at the end, all you need is one number. The problem here is you have a huge amount of numbers, and one of the big challenges would be to save it. So there's all this energy we have been burning, actually is being used, can be used later for something, to do analysis on the data. And I think there's a real challenge. I personally think this is an enormous challenge.
So if you
make databases of this, because look, you will only get this once. You will only get the money to run a big code with. The big simulation ones, right? They will tell you, this is, we all come together, we say we want to run one big, you know, 8,000, 2,000, you know, we want to run the simulation, right?
Yeah.
We all come together, and then we run it, and then at the end we have 42, well, it's not totally cut it. I mean, you will have to use the data for something and be able to access it, and for that you need a lot of computational power.
Yeah.
To analyze the data, you need a lot of computational power. and a lot of bandwidth. So one of the big challenges would be really what you said, where it's at the end somewhere, is really access to data. I mean, this would be really.
Yeah, then actually, if they. To run this kind of simulation actually can be, on one hand, it's very demanding. And then on the other hand, I have to say that makes me very nervous. What if we make a mistake? What if we have a bug in the code somewhere along the way? And don't know about it until we get close to the end.
Well, because you get 43 instead of 42.
Right.
So, no, I mean, it's a big question, right? I mean, because usually we all know that you have to do a lot of test runs and then you find your right, it might be wrong. You might have to repeat it a few times, but that's part of the game, right?
Mm-hmm. Question.
Yes, question.
Actually, I have two comments.
Yes.
The first one is about the public codes.
Yeah.
We have a code already in the public domain, which is not a spectral code. It's a six-order finite difference code. It's called pencil code. It's fully parallelizable under MPI, scales very well. So there is a public code. It also has particles in it. But this is not a spectral code, however. Mm-hmm. So that is one of the things that people may like to get interested in. Anyone can download it, run it. There is a manual which is probably now 150 pages long. That's probably not a good news, of course. So that's one comment. The other one is a bit of blunt comment, if you forgive me. Let us first think about the 4096 cube simulation done by Kaneda. What has it produced other than a few beautiful pictures? So is it really worthwhile asking the question of scaling exponents with DNSS now? I mean, we are going nowhere doing this, right? We don't. I mean, if you look at 4096 cube simulation, it didn't even reach a steady state. So that was totally useless. We had 2048 cube simulation in that paper. That for the first time in a DNS showed a 5-third scaling. But we don't even know whether there is intermittency correction even in the second order. So do you think that the 8192 cube can give us something? Because if we go on this way,
well,
other communities will justifiably say that turbulence doesn't deserve any money.
Well, let's say, I think there's no question that Yoko can do this well and has a great impact on the community. I would even think that the only reason that NSF require blue waters to be able to simulate turbulence as that great resolution within that many hours is because of what they did in Japan.
I agree.
And if that was not done, we in the turbulence community would be somewhat worse off, I would say.
I agree, but this is more of a political news than a scientific news. Because NSF thinks that there is something in Japan which beats US, so we need to give more money.
Look, I mean, you do with it. That's why I was pushing so much the data side, because the important part is that the data is readable and can be reanalyzed. As long as the data is not accessible to the large community of scientists, you have a new model. You cannot test it on the data because the data is gone. And I completely
agree, but the 4096 cube data is useless. It's not even steady state.
What PK was pointing out, right? He said you have a little, just a typo in the program and the data would be useless.
Okay, so we go to the maximum size and then get a set of data that's useless. It is better to stay on a slightly lower size and run it longer.
Data. I mean, this is what it means. It was just not enough. What that means is this 4096 one was not good enough because we figured out that parts of it were not converged, but we need better resolution. So we have to do more.
No, we don't need better resolution for convergence. We need to run it longer for convergence.
Yeah, so we have to run it longer.
That you can do only in smaller size.
But
so
that's
going for the biggest size is not the best idea. That's what I'm saying. It's better to stay at a slightly smaller size and do more
careful analysis.
Well, the benefits of the simulation depend very much on how long the simulation is run.
Exactly.
And my understanding is that the simulation or the off simulator was not very long. And just like us here, I think turbulence researchers in Japan have a hard time getting enough computer time also. That's part of the reason why that simulation has not been run longer. And we try to get simulated turbulence at least above 5 Viti transfer times. That is, I won't say very long, but that is sufficient to give us something. Okay. And also, we're going to have some scalars. We're going to have some free particles here to make sure that we what we get is not just an Eulerian velocity field. This is a very difficult issue because if somebody were to say declare this machine is going to be used for turbulence only, then we solve all the problems. But the reality is that if we get 5% of the hours available on that machine, we'll be very lucky.
But that would be okay, right? No?
That would be, yeah, that's about what we can ask for.
I mean, we wouldn't mind, right? I mean, getting 5% of that machine.
No, that, you cannot ask for more than that, I think.
You
cannot ask for more than that.
I have two short questions. First, of course, going to higher resolution is a sort of incremental work. It's like, you know, in a high energy physics accelerator, having higher energy. And so what do you expect to see? I mean, do you expect to see an X particle? Or, I mean, what is the new physics, in your opinion, which really needs larger resolution, higher Reynolds? So this is our first question.
And the question, what is the difference in physics we don't get from...
In 2018, we'll probably be going to be able to have a larger Reynolds lambda.
Yeah.
What are the things that you believe are going to be the new physics that you are going to get out of that?
Well...
Because many things you can just study at a smaller resolution, and I perfectly agree that in many cases statistical accuracy is actually more important than Reynolds number.
If I can make a comment on what you just said, when the high energy community build a new accelerator, they get a Nobel Prize. When our computer size increases, we get nowhere.
This is the first question, but there is a connected the second question. But
a question, maybe.
I don't know if I shouldn't want to delineate the question. I mean, the one thing is to say to go to higher, more resolution. That doesn't mean higher Reynolds number. That just means better resolution and what you simulate. And possibly constant Reynolds number, right? You can keep the Reynolds number constant and just get the resolution down at the small scales where we know something seems to be happening at the smaller scale.
Well, but I think that by now the ratio of K max eta,
always the question is always very difficult. We're going to have, even though that this is going to be a very powerful machine that will be finite, and the CPU hours we get will be finite. The Reynolds number, if you wonder how much will we go up, I would say it's probably going up to around 1,000 to 1,600. So frankly, I've run into some problems when I write proposals based on that statement because somebody said, is that a really big jump or not? Okay, and you can say whatever nice things about it you want, but the reality, of course, that is not a very big jump because it's a turbulence after all. We are never going to be able to reach sufficiently high Reynolds numbers for all of our purposes. If you say, from a Lagrangian point of view, for example, the ratio of time scale is only about 80, and now them to 400. I'm sorry, and now them to 1,000. And it goes up linearly with the Reynolds number. When are we going to get 1,000? Probably never.
You would like to have 1,000 instead of 80.
Right. So what we have to do, I think what we have to be better at is how we extrapolate what we have towards the higher Reynolds number that we are not going to be able to reach, and we're not going to be able to get CPU hours for, frankly. I mean, if you, as I said, if the machine like this were devoted by turbulence, we would solve most of our problems. may say, we may not be able to get higher, but it's not.
You don't get the ratio 1,000, right?
Right, I mean, right.
It depends what is your milestone, what do you want to get.
Right.
Okay, let me be.
Yes, sure.
So there are
other questions, Peter.
I just comment about the bachelor regime. That you told about power spectra, its approach at that large Schmidt number, approach K-1.
Yeah.
Like an experiment, it's very difficult to get this K-1 in principle in stationary. You spoke about bachelor stationary mixing. Usually you have decay regime. And in decay regime, this boundary, which is always an experiment, you don't have K-1 in prediction. It's the Lebedev and Chekhov made prediction about K in power minus beta, and beta is prior proportional to Peclia minus Planck water, which is not K minus one. Therefore, the problem here, the boundary changed drastically the scale. For K minus one, it's for a very large Schmidt number that we're working, like Peclia number, it's very difficult to see the difference, but in principle.
Is that because of whether the flow becomes stationary or not?
Because, first of all, it's not, people work in decay regime, not in stationary. In stationary, very difficult to do experiment, because very fast you get continuous, smooth distribution. Therefore, it's better to work in decay regime, and decay regime with boundary, which is a channel regular thing. You didn't get gaming as well.
Well, we...
It's difficult to differentiate in experiment because the resolution is not.
Right.
But in numerical simulation, probably you can do.
No, well...
But theory, it's not K-1. Therefore, it's all story by Bachelor for unbounded system, for stationary energy, and K-1.
Do we know how robust numerical results are to changing numerical scheme? I mean, if we did do it with pencil or something, would we expect to get things at 1% precision, Tammy, or just how precise we are at the moment?
The Markov scheme, you mean
something other than
both the time differencing as well as the spatial
time integration, or moving away from a pseudo spectral.
We have made some comparison between Wenschke second order and Wenschke fourth order. I'm not, as far as I know, there are no very obvious differences. We are dealing with homogeneous turbulence, so we are restricted to pseudo spectral methods. And so of course the accuracy of the results depends on the resolution. For example, if we look at some quantities very sensitive to the small scale, higher order quantities, then we have some understanding about how resolution changes the picture. For example, if we are not resolving the small scales well enough, then the higher order moments are smaller because we are not capturing some of the extreme events. But then it seems that some of the main conclusions, like for example, the connection between the free particle acceleration and dissipation fluctuation, for example, whether entropy is more intermittent than dissipation, that qualitative trend still holds. Although in some cases we may not be resolving sufficiently well, we may not be resolving everything sufficiently well. So I mean, there was a little sense of panic, I think, when I recall when I first saw Gustav Sweeney's paper shortly before it was published, 2005, Yehot and Sweeney. So they were saying that at a certain number of brick points, now you have to go to, you cannot have the kind of Reynolds numbers that we have. If you're going to resolve the small scale very well, 4096 scripts in DNS may give you around lambda 300. And that would give you very accurate results at a high order moment. I imagine that that may be too specialized. Okay. I think it's easier in my experience, I think it's easier to get CPU hours to investigate something new compared to, say, if we're going to investigate something again and see whether the previous results are very accurate or not. That argument is a little bit more difficult to make.
But by going to hiring all somebody, that's what we are doing.
Pardon?
I mean, we are not going beyond homogeneous isotropic turbulence in some sense. I'm saying that you could have equally well used this 8192 cube simulation to do something different, like MHD simulation.
So shear.
Yeah.
Well, I could say a little bit more.
Yeah. Yeah. If you do homogeneous isotropic,
we wrote a proposal to NSF for assessing blue waters. And I'm not the only person on the proposal. The other two are Bob Moser and Jim Wiley. Bob Moser, as you know, works on is known for channel flows, and Jim Wiley is chemically reacting and stratified flows. So we are actually going to run. We get all the hours that we wanted. We are going to run three large simulations. The others I call 8192 cube equivalent. That's like if you're a channel flow. Number quick point is not the cube of anything, right? But then we could aim for roughly the same number of quick points, roughly the same amount of computational work.
So in other words, what you're just saying is the answer to Federico's question is you're looking at more complicated simulations.
Yeah.
Right. I mean that's one of, and then more detail on things that we couldn't look at before. Right.
Yes.
It's not just getting the Reynolds number up, it's really,
right.
You want to do it also, right? You want to do that for sure also, but that's not the end game.
Well, I'm not completely sure because you can see things that you have not seen before. For example, by increasing the statistics, yeah. We were discussing about this rare event and particle in vortex filament. If you want to study those things, it's much better to have, instead of one single snapshot, to have larger statistics. But I understand that it may be easier to get a proposal if you propose to make a bigger simulation rather than a longer simulation. Is this the case, or?
If I propose a what?
Bigger than longer. If you propose to do a bigger simulation,
yes.
You may get more chance to see your proposal granted rather than just saying, you know, I want to.
A bigger simulation versus a longer simulation. I think
or
a big.
The same or something new, right?
Well, but you're going to get something
yeah.
new, you know, by
increasing
the statistics.
I think a bigger question.
Homogeneous shear flows, we know that if you do a very big massive simulation for very small time steps, I mean, very small time window, you won't get any.
But any system with turbulence, any system with small statistics.
Yeah, exactly, I completely
agree. From a theoretical point of view, there is an interest to push Reynolds in homogeneous and isotropic turbulence. And the interest is concerned to also what you mentioned at some point, that apparently, up to now, all data from numerical simulation done at any resolution in homogeneous and isotropic statistics show that energy dissipation or vorticity square scales in a different way as a function of Reynolds, first. And second, they show that longitudinal velocity increments and the transverse velocity increments have a slightly different scaling. From a theoretical point of view, if you are isotropic, this is unexplainable. I mean, we don't have, nobody is able to explain why it should be so. So one issue would be push Reynolds, stay as isotropic as you can. It is something that you can do only in the numerics. Of course, and see if these discrepancies are going to evaporate by increasing Reynolds. These discrepancies between longitudinal and transverse is also connected to universality in some sense. Because, I mean, again, if longitudinal and transverse scales in different way in a purely isotropic ensemble, then different isotropic forcing may have different input of energy on the longitudinal and on the transverse. So if they scale different, within the same isotropic forcing, you could have different statistics which breaks the hypothesis of universality. So this is, I mean, it's a very refined question, of course, I mean, because then people can say you are never isotropic and so on and so, and the effect is very small. But it is out of error bars at the moment.
I thought in one of your papers you showed that one shouldn't talk about longitudinal transfers, but break up into angular momentum sectors of L equal to 0, 1, and 2, and then each of these sectors you get a new exponent.
But if you are isotropic, there is only the isotropic sector.
Yes, but because...
And the issue is that within the isotropic sector, you have different eigenfunctions which are isotropic. One is the longitudinal, the other is the transverse, or any other combination.
But because your grid is cubic, you will always have some effect.
No, but it's negligible. It's invisible.
So, do you have a comment?
Yeah, but I was going to ask.
Oh, you were asking something.
I figured we'd
talk about
that. So, yeah.
I move it down. My computer is your one.
Go back to the scalar spectra that you showed for.
It won't show because we have to wait under the thickness.
The one you showed me in your office.
Right, there's a halogen lamp in there which needs to.
Sorry. So I'm not.
Yeah, it's not yet. He draws it here. So why don't we wipe out the thing in the space?
The initial convective range, right?
Yeah. That one? No, the one that showed the 17 thirds power.
Oh, that's the one. This line is just about 17 over 3.
Right. So where do you think the
peak of the energy dissipation range, I would say somewhere here.
Right. So Townsend theory is actually this more general. Mm-hmm. So that when we're going into the dissipation range, we expect the spectrum of the scalar to fall off faster than the 17 thirds. In fact, exponentially faster. So beyond here, we don't expect to see the minus 17.
No, I think.
We don't expect minus 17 thirds. We expect minus 12 thirds multiplied by E of K.
Okay, well, I know at least from this point onwards, this is not quite right.
Right.
Okay, because we can only trust the data roughly above this point.
But the comparison, if you're comparing with Bachelor-Hell-Townsend theory, the comparison should be this, not only. Also, they state very clearly that as you go deeper into the dissipation range, your approximations become inaccurate. So this cannot continue indefinitely into the dissipation range to be comparable to the state.
Yeah, I would say that I would trust the line C more than D in this part.
Okay.
Yeah.
Most of this is probably viscous diffusive.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So the other suggestion is you can evaluate it.
Okay, I'll look at that.
So that you can show how their theory begins to fail as you go into the dissipation.
Yes. Thanks for the suggestion.
Well, thank you very much. So, just to continue the